First, though, it's time for Correspondence Report with Nick Grimm.
Thanks, Hugh. Welcome to the program. On the show today, Indonesia correspondent David Lipson gets a grandstand view of the nation's corruption problems, and National Indigenous Affairs correspondent Bridget Brennan's stint in the US provides a new perspective on how disadvantaged communities are helping themselves. Those stories coming up. But we'll go straight away today to our first report filed by our new Europe correspondent, Linton Besser, who's been settling into his London digs. And it's been a busy few weeks since he hit the ground there with a real-life spy drama taking centre stage in the UK. Turns out the intrigue and drama of those events conveyed him back to his first experience of the city within the pages of a book. And sure enough, it's a real page-turner.
The ring of footsteps down a cobbled alley. The fog rolling up off the Thames. An unassuming man in a grey overcoat moving off his park bench in Battersea, but leaving a rolled-up newspaper behind him. This is the London I first ventured to, a labyrinth of grimy alleyways, opulent government offices, and drab curtained safe houses. It was a London fashioned from the pages of John le Carré.
If one tells the truth, one is sure, sooner or later, to be found out.
That's le Carré quoting Oscar Wilde and reading from A Delicate Truth, one of his 35 books, short stories and plays. Le Carré is, of course, just his pen name. He was born David John Moore Cornwall in 1931 and was forced to adopt the name le Carré when he began to publish his writing, because in his day job, he was a spy for the British Secret Intelligence Service.
"They tell me you're a seasoned member of the service. That right?" he says accusingly, in his carefully nurtured Glaswegian accent, after a head-to-toe inspection that seems to confirm his worst fears.
I moved to London only a few weeks ago as one of the ABC's Europe correspondents. But it was really John le Carré who first transported me here decades ago. From Regent's Park to Hampstead Heath, he carried me in the back of government town cars and rattling black cabs to and from clandestine meetings. So now I'm here, I've decided to retrace the steps of his most loved spies and bureaucrats and blowhard ministers of the crown.
All right, here's my question. Have you had any direct experience of secret intelligence work? You personally, he warns, as if there is another you who is less personal. Direct in what sense would that be, Minister? Cloak and dagger stuff, what do you think?
In most of Le Carré's novels, the centre of power in this secret cloak and dagger world was dubbed the circus. So I went out this week to try to find it. I've walked up from Leicester Square tube station and come to Cambridge Circus. And I'm in front of a building which is number 90, Charing Cross Road. And this appears to me to be exactly the kind of building that John le Carré described, where he placed his fictional British Intelligence Service. It's a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It's a 6-story red brick building. Across the bottom, there's a tapas restaurant, a cute looking musical instrument shop, and worst of all, underneath the building, there's a brand new McDonald's restaurant. Le Carré fashioned a city teeming with spies and traitors. And so, in my imagination, sprung a metropolis permanently dogged by the professional deceptions of secret agents and their snitches. And I've thought a bit about this since moving here, because on the 5th of September, this was my first major story.
Good evening and welcome to the BBC News at 6. Two Russian military intelligence officers have been accused of carrying out the Novichok attacks.
Suddenly, I was thrust onto the scene of a real-life spy drama where a chemical weapon was disguised as perfume and smuggled into the country in an international assassination plot.
They entered the UK on Russian passports under the names Alexander Petrov and Ruslan Boshirov. But authorities say these were mere cover names. And the two men were in fact secret agents working for Russian military intelligence.
Le Carré's readers would hardly recognise the apparent bungling of these two men, whose assassination attempt on the former Russian double agent Sergei Skripal failed, and whose faces had been captured by CCTV cameras and were now being splashed across the front pages of the world's newspapers. His readers are far more used to the quiet extraction of secrets from highly placed sources in the Cold War hotspots of Berlin and Prague. They were secrets which inevitably would be digested and analysed by stuffy civil servicemen in Whitehall offices and their political masters. Now I'm walking up King Charles Street. It's the old cabinet war rooms just off Whitehall. And it's so easy to imagine that up in one of these offices above me, there would have been the plotting and scheming and strategizing of diplomats and intelligence officers who were playing what John Le Carré and many others have described as the great game. My love of John Le Carré's spy novels has paled somewhat as I register the very real price that's been paid for Russia's meddling in the United Kingdom. The botched hit job on Sergei Skripal rocked the country when a civilian, a British mother of three, accidentally stumbled over the deadly nerve agent used against Skripal and subsequently died. It's rare for the secret and dirty work of governments to slip into view. Though the British government dragged its most secretive agency into the public glare in 1994 when it opened the new headquarters of MI6 in a massive pyramid-like building at Vauxhall, only a short walk from my new ABC office. I don't think I've ever seen a building that bristles more with security cameras than this giant edifice at Vauxhall, right on the River Thames. It's a monstrosity, it has to be said. It's just enormous. What a world away it is from the architecture of intelligence that John Le Carré painted so beautifully. Since I've been here, I've sat down with a former British spymaster for a coffee, and he assures me the great game is alive and well. It might have shed the Cold War anachronisms that John Le Carré skewered, but somewhere in London, there are men and women at this very moment being pressed into service still.
Oh, Minister, if you consider me the right man, I shall be happy to accept the assignment, whatever it may be.
This is Linton Besser in London for Correspondence Report.
As most tourists visiting Bali discover, small-scale corruption comes with the territory. Police officers who stop motorists demand either upfront cash or the alternative, a date with a Bali courtroom. It might seem petty in most instances, but nationwide corruption is a real problem. And at next year's national election, as many as 200 politicians who've served time for corruption crimes will appear on ballot papers. And as Indonesia correspondent David Lipson discovered, efforts to shine a light into Indonesia's dark corners can be a deadly game.
There's an old joke that does the rounds in some of Jakarta's diplomatic circles that Indonesia is a country with enormous potential and always will be. There are perhaps many reasons this dynamic and resource-rich nation, which has an annual growth of more than 5%, perhaps hasn't reached its full potential. A land of mountains and islands, its geography is challenging to say the least. Militant groups have discouraged the potential for a mega tourism boom. But one of the most glaring and pernicious economic dead weights here is corruption. On a recent trip to the outskirts of Jakarta for a story about farming, we came across a big new grandstand in the middle of a field. It looked somewhat out of place because the only path to it was a disused, almost undrivable dirt track. On closer inspection, it was totally bizarre because the grandstand looked over, get this, absolutely nothing. I don't just mean no goalposts or line markings on a pitch, I mean no pitch at all. There wasn't even a flat piece of ground, just lumps of earth and old irrigation channels overgrown with weeds. A few laughing teenagers were sitting up in the stand, perhaps wagging school to use it for the only thing it was good for these days, watching the grass grow. Despite its fresh lick of paint, the grandstand had already fallen victim to damage from vandals and graffiti. Another year or two and it would be close to unusable. As a journalist, I must admit a failure when it comes to investigating who was responsible and whether they gained financially out of this grandstand. I just don't have the time to look into everything I see here. But what took me aback was the casual acceptance that the locals had to the grandstand. Oh, it'd just be some politician or party that needed to raise some funds, I was told. They'd have got one of their own construction companies to build it with taxpayer funds and skimmed off the profit. Indeed, you see and hear about corruption everywhere here, whether it's expats debating the right price for bribing a Jakarta traffic cop, or the recent news story about the Malang City Council in East Java, where 41 out of 45 councillors were implicated in a bribery case, with so many locked up that the council was unlikely to achieve a quorum. The government institution responsible for weeding out corruption in this target-rich environment is the KPK, the Corruption Eradication Commission, and it's done some brave and impressive work since it was established in the early 2000s. Barely a week goes by when the KPK isn't in the media for busting some low-level politician or public servant, and they've caught some big fish too. In an address to the Jakarta Foreign Correspondents Club recently, Indonesia's most famous corruption buster at the KPK, Novel Baswedan, didn't mince his words. As you already know, he said, corruption in Indonesia is not a secret. It's quite massive, it's pervasive, it is quite prevalent everywhere across the country. He explained the efforts made to fight corruption going back decades, and the reason they've largely failed. Political intervention. The problem remains the same, he says. Intervention recurring again and again. But at this time, the intervention has become more substantial and conducted in a more professional way. Novel Baswedan knows more than anyone the danger of speaking so plainly. While investigating a major embezzlement case in April last year, he was walking home from morning prayers when two men on motorbikes threw hydrochloric acid in his face, burning the sight from his left eye. After 10 months of surgeries and eye treatments, he returned to work as a corruption buster at the KPK in February this year, more determined than ever to shine a light in dark corners. After hours, he's also investigating the very acid attack that left him partially blind, because he claims it should have been solved already. Again, he suspects intervention. In my case, he says, there are items of evidence that were eliminated. There were CCTV records that were not used, and there were witnesses who were intimidated. Frighteningly, he says, the cases of intimidation of KPK officials that the public is aware of are just the tip of the iceberg. He cited bombs, attempted murders, and kidnappings that have never been disclosed. As election season heats up here, tackling corruption will no doubt be a promise made by each of the many political parties running candidates. But even before the campaign proper gets underway, there is cause for despair. The Supreme Court has just overruled a KPK regulation that would have banned ex-corruption convicts from running for office. The General Elections Commission, the KPU, says around 40 former corruption convicts are on the ballot papers for legislative seats in the House of Representatives, the Regional Legislative Council, and the Regional Representatives Council. The Jakarta Post even published a handy graphic so you could compare and contrast which party was running the most ex-convict candidates. For the record, Gerindra, the party of presidential challenger Prabowo Subianto, topped the list with five, while President Joko Widodo's party, PDIP, had none. But it gets worse. The Election Commission says it had previously disqualified around 160 other candidates because of their criminal records in graft cases. The Supreme Court's ruling may see all of them back on the ballot paper. 200 crooks in all convicted of corruption running for office. As a last resort, the Commission is considering putting marks on the ballot papers to indicate which candidates were corrupt in the past. I'm thinking an image of a little pair of handcuffs would do the trick. This is David Lipson in Jakarta for Correspondence Report.
Listeners will no doubt be familiar with the ABC's National Indigenous Affairs correspondent, Bridget Brennan, who's just spent a month on secondment in our Washington Bureau in the US. Now, here at home, she gets to travel the country, speaking to our First Nations communities right across Australia. Along the way, she finds a lot of joy, but she also sees plenty of hardship and poverty in black communities that are struggling. Well, she discovered echoes of those experiences while on assignment in Chicago, where Bridget came upon stories of self-determination in communities battling against disinvestment, unemployment, violence, and negative perceptions. Here's her report.
In my job as National Indigenous Affairs correspondent for the ABC, I'm often going to communities when something terrible is happening. There might be violence, drug and alcohol abuse, or just general despair over living conditions. Social dysfunction happens in marginalised communities for a range of complex and historic reasons. We know this, and we do need to cover these issues because oftentimes people will tell you as a reporter that they really want to speak to you about the ills they're confronting. And it's why I've been in Chicago looking at the devastating rates of gun violence in parts of the city. The thing is, though, when I go on these trips, I really grapple with something as a journalist. I wonder if I'm doing the right thing by diverse communities. Are we just focusing on their downfalls instead of what makes them strong? But what I've found reporting on these types of stories is that you inevitably find really strong examples of self-determination, no matter how bad things might seem in neighbourhoods. I always seem to find people who, despite facing apathetic politicians or structural inequality or racism, they're getting on with the job. I see this all the time in Aboriginal communities, and I found it in Chicago recently where I was thrilled to meet Aisha Butler. She's a really warm and generous black community leader who's doing something different to confront gun violence. She's been leading a mini urban revival in parts of the south side of Chicago, holding block parties and barbecues, and she's mobilised hundreds of volunteers to build community spaces to give kids a safe space in poor neighbourhoods.
Really just a place where people can come and just chill, feel safe. I almost use the gate as a shield, like a shield away from any violence or anything that's going wrong on the block.
And previously this block wasn't as safe as it is now?
No, not at all. This block had experienced several shootings, several homicides on the, somebody died there, somebody died in the back of the house over there. And so we just, once we purchased the lot, we was able to really come out and do things around healing, drumming circles, African drumming circles, and kind of just like ease the hurt that people had on the block and use this space to do that.
David Peterson Jr. talks a lot about reclaiming the narrative. He runs the Pullman Porter Museum in Chicago's South Side, and he uses the museum to mentor teenagers who come in after school to learn about history and African-American activism.
We care about our neighborhood, and you know, we take pride in the fact that this is one of the safest neighborhoods in the hundreds, the wild hundreds, as they call it. But I mean, these kids are thinkers, they're speakers, they're scholars.
Good afternoon, my name is Thomas Bullock, and I'm here at Museum 44 with Hip Hop.
At the Pullman Porter Museum, teenagers are here upstairs to record their own podcast. And even they tell me it's important for them to tell their story, to shake off perceptions that this part of Chicago is only known for violence. This is 15-year-old Thomas Bullock.
It's not a lot of good things that they show about Chicago. They show mostly all of the bad things, which gives people the wrong perception of this area.
So in Chicago, I was so saddened by what's happened to some of these beautiful neighbourhoods, which have been really torn apart by violence. But as always, I was so inspired by the communities here that refuse to leave and refuse to give in to perceptions about them being violent and broken, they're going to stay here and work to change things. This is Bridget Brennan, reporting for Correspondence Report.
That's all from Correspondence Report this week. I'm Nick Grimm. My thanks to technical producer Mark Cash. Join us at the same time next week for more thoughts and stories from the ABC's foreign correspondents. Now it's back to Hugh Rimmington and Sunday Extra.
Thank you, Nick.